Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.
Hello and welcome to Symposium 7 of the Lotus Eaters. I'm joined today by Bo.
Hey.
And we are going to talk about patriotism. Now, patriotism is supposed to be love of one's country, and it is supposed to be to involve a sentiment of identification with one's country. So I wanted to ask you, Bo, if you think that the notion of personal identity has a historical dimension into it. And whether the study of history is associated, in a sense, with not only personal identity, but also kind of national identity.
Yeah, well, I mean, the first thing that springs to mind when asked a question like that is, in Homer, he talks about if a Greek man doesn't have a city, it doesn't have a polis, that's terrible. That's terrible for him. It's really, really sad for him and also like embarrassing. It's just one of the worst things that could ever happen to someone is to not have, well, in the ancient sense, a city state, but in our world, it would be a nation state. You know, at the Olympics, there's sometimes a few people that are stateless.
Yeah.
You know, so it is possible to be stateless. But yeah, I think most people in the world, there's some part of their identity is bound up, whether they like it or not. Whether they're ashamed of it or hate it or not, is bound up with their nation.
And would you say that studying history and also writing history can be seen as endeavors that try to sustain kind of national identity? Or in some cases where we have revisionary accounts of history, when we have accounts of history that try to undermine national identity?
Yeah.
What would you say about
that? Yeah, both those things. Absolutely both those things. Yeah, it used to be the case in like the 19th century or before that it was just a no-brainer. Of course you sort of wrote a history from the perspective of your country, your nation. Whereas much more, well, in the 20th century as well, you know, revisionist, that sort of the Marxist lens of history sort of got out of control, I would argue, in the 20th century, to the point where you're deliberately trying to undermine your own. You write a history to undermine your own country. Like, for example, even now you're going to Waterstones or W.H. Smith and you pick up a paperback history book, someone like Niall Ferguson or something. And yeah, it's completely trying to destroy all sorts of things that are at the heart of our national identity, calling us really terrible things. Like I was reading something the other day by Niall Ferguson. He was talking about a white plague. That colonialism or the British Empire or something was a white plague.
So, okay,
so that's not objective. That's not being objective, is it? That's
so,
partisan.
I want to ask you one thing because I think that there is this idea going along that history should be written objectively. And
we'll try to. Yeah, you'll never be able to do that exactly, but try to at least.
But
strive for that.
I wanted to ask you because this has always struck me as weird. As you mentioned, the Marxist perspective of historiography, it is somehow based on the idea that we cannot be objective, but somehow we are to think that Marxist history is objective.
Yeah.
So I cannot understand this because I don't know if this follows from the tenets of dialectical materialism that I think we should say that they come forward with Engels. Marx didn't write about them, but there is this idea that going along that our thoughts are determined by our position in society and our relation, our position with respect to the means of production and to the relations of production in the Marxist paradigm. Yeah. So I don't see why, on the one hand, they are attacking history as historiography as non-objective, but on the other hand, they think that they're supposed to be thinking that theirs is objective, or they present it as objective. Isn't that a bit weird?
They're just hypocrites, yeah. It's just a double standard, as simple as that. Yeah, one rule for them and one rule for everyone else.
So do you think that there are ways of mitigating the idea of non-objective history? So what should the historian do? Should we write, for instance, that, you know, we have a biases, and reader, be mindful of the fact that we have those biases?
Probably about the best you can hope for. Mm. It is impossible to be truly objective. It's impossible to really do that. It's impossible to know the past with complete certitude. You can barely say what's happening in the present with objectivity, right? So in a past that's, the past is profoundly lost to us. You can never go back, can never see it again. So it will always be, on some level, a narrative. All history will be a narrative of some level with some, and it won't be objective. So the best you can hope for is to inform your audience of that and keep that in mind while you read my version of history.
And I think that we should be mindful of the fact that novels or books in the contemporary sense were a sort of Renaissance invention. Mm. People in, for instance, in antiquity, they had no books in the way we have them today. They had long scrolls and they were handwriting them. And the more they were... we had monks, for instance, who were reading those scrolls and they were copying by hand. And as language was changing, they also started, there were lots of issues in translation. Mm. So this is a really interesting stuff about how we can read about the past.
Yeah, and even before that, you've got the oral tradition. I mentioned Homer already, but something like the Iliad or the Odyssey is before... It was passed down just through word of mouth and remembering it before it was ever written down for a long time. But yeah, the idea of the novel, you mentioned the novel there. I've read a little bit of sort of literary analysis about what was the first novel.
Yeah.
And what most people say, it was sort of in the 18th century, 19th century. But some even say, in a sense, the Odyssey is the first novel.
Yeah.
Of course, not in our modern sense of what a novel is. In a way, you could argue. There's no nice clean answer to that, but
So I wonder whether the idea of sustaining a national identity is not just put forward by books, or whether it's there is a notion of national identity or the identity of a people across time that is somehow sustained by people and their customs and their memories, their identification with particular groups, their commemoration of past tragedies and triumphs. What would you say about that?
Yeah, all those things. Yeah. A matrix of 1,001 different things that go into making in each individual person's mind their concept of their country and their relationship to it. I think in just to sort of cut to the quick on what we're getting at here is that there's been lots of, in our modern times, there's lots and lots of opposition and criticism to patriotism.
Yes.
And nationalism and the very idea of nations, and that there's something, or not even in our modern times, I mean, it goes back centuries, that there's something wrong-headed and weird about being a patriot. I just reject nearly all of that. I'm not going to inch the Overton window back. I'm just going to pick the whole Overton window up and move it entirely and just say, no, that nearly all of that comes from like anarchists, leftists, socialists, people that want to destroy nation states for their own reasons. So they'll just deride it all. They'll say, what's a classic line? It's actually sometimes, I think, taken out of context, but that patriotism is the last resort of the scoundrel or something like that.
I think so.
Yeah, I think it was Samuel Adams, and it's taken out of context. But nonetheless, it stands alone as a statement. I just reject all of that. That's people that want to undermine and destroy nations for other nefarious reasons.
I think it's you raise a really important point, and I think we should be a bit historical in how we approach it and see how we got into today's mess, in a way. Yeah. So I think that in a way, the concepts we use nowadays to describe our political reality are very much influenced by Cold War ideology, or by the way that the Cold War was portrayed ideologically. So, for instance, we use words like left and right. And many people nowadays think that these are not the optimal words in which we should describe our current political struggles. So I think that throughout history, maybe that's a generalization, but I think it's a conjecture that is worth putting forward. And tell me if you think that it is wrong. I'm really open to being convinced otherwise. But I think that in most cases, the public is thinking in terms of really simplistic dilemmas, in terms of A or B. And I think that this is problematic because it's always more complex than that. It is really easy to address the whole public because not everyone is as educated as the other person in the public, but it is really easy to put forward a simplistic dilemma to address the lowest common denominator. So I think that through the Cold War, we were presented with the dilemma of individualism on the one hand, or extreme individualism, that it knows no group or recognizes no belonging into a group. And on the other hand, collectivism that was associated with the Soviet Union. And I think that this way of putting forward this simplistic dilemma led many people to think that in let's say, the Western world, in Western countries, led many people to think that somehow any form of group or a group identity is bad and inherently a threat to individual people. And I think that that was also magnified by the fact that those who were in the USSR camp, both based in the USSR and outside it, like I think Sartre, for instance, they did present every form of group that is not the class or the proletariat or, the students later in the 60s as a form of fascism. So I think that it is very important to dissociate this and show and reassert the idea that there can be groups that they're not, that they are on the one hand important for individuals to belong to, but they are not fascist. Or I think we should stop. We should stop thinking in terms of the old left, in terms of the old Cold War, USSR backed left wants its opponents to think. What do you think about this?
Yeah, you've touched on a number of interesting things there. Yeah, I think just as the one of the last things you said, just to say that lots of people on the left, Guardianistas, people like that, want to equate any populism, any hint of populism or nationalism with being a Nazi.
Yes.
If you even like the tiniest hint of civic nationalism, if you hear a populist dog whistle and you don't immediately take up an Antifa flag, then you are Goebbels. You are Hitler.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just absolute crazy nonsense. Yeah, just because because Mussolini and Hitler were nationalists, it doesn't mean that every aspect of all nationalism is complete, barbarous, monstrous insanity.
Yeah.
Not at all. But that's what they want you to think, of course. That's what they want. But the Cold War thing is really interesting, and the outmoded paradigm of the left and the right. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. But it's easy for people, it's shorthand, isn't it? It's easy for people still to use it. But I think you're absolutely right that it's a bit outmoded. I mean, I would say, although it's still very simplistic, what I'm about to say, is that it's left less a math in my mind. People may well disagree with what I'm about to say heavily, but I hope not. But it might be less a case of left and right, and globalists and non-globalists.
Yeah.
It's more that people that want a globalized world and no borders and no nations, and people that don't want that.
Yep.
It's not left and right. It's more globalists and non-globalists. That seems to make a bit more sense. It's still very, very simple. Still very, very simplified. But because left and right, really, there's this old paradigm of left and right. It's sort of there's lots of economics that are bound up in that. I read an interesting book where it was talking about how Edmund Burke and Thomas Paine in the late 18th century set the tone for what became left and right. And it's not just politics, there's lots of economics. There's a few different layers of ideology, whereas now in the paradigm I just mentioned of globalists and non-globalists, it's less about economy, really, and it's more about demographic change. It's more about all sorts of other ideologies.
I think that's correct. And by the way, a small parenthesis. I think this book you are mentioning is a bit simplistic, and it may be worth discussing it in the future.
I'd love to. It's called The Great Debate. I think it's fairly well-known.
Yeah, it's about Thomas Paine and Edmund Burke and how their debate, I think, primarily about the French Revolution.
And the American Revolution.
Yes.
And the French Revolution. Yeah, because they lived at the same time and wrote lots of letters to each other.
And wasn't it Paine who told Burke, my friend, come here to Paris?
Yeah, I mean, they were very, very aggressive and rude to each other in writing.
Yeah.
But when they met, I think only once, they were very, very polite and nice to each other. They were friends, but intellectually extreme enemies.
I think we should say what you want about Thomas Paine. He was not a good travel guide. Paris was not the place to go at the time.
He ended up fleeing for his life, I believe.
Yeah,
we would have been guillotined if he didn't get out of there. If I remember rightly,
So back to this point, I think that it's very interesting to see again how this arises, because I think that after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union, there was a kind of violating Scarface's law in the West. I think people in the West got high with their own supply.
Oh, okay. Right,
and I think the most representative specimen of that rhetoric comes from Francis Fukuyama.
Fukuyama, right, okay.
He said that, we have reached the end of history.
Yeah, we've won.
We've won.
Western liberal democracy has won the world, all of history. Yes. We've done it. It's the end. Yeah,
exactly. Western parliamentary democracy, liberal democracy is the end of history. It's the best form of social organization. And if we try to liberalize the whole world is going to become great. And there will be no wars, nothing. I think that this is a kind of grand narrative of the Enlightenment that, if we try to basically follow this principle to the letter, we are going to live in heaven on earth. We are going to create earth. We are going to turn earth into a heaven. But this hasn't happened. And I want to ask you, because it seems to me that there is a really interesting book by Archie Brown, I think The Rise and Fall of Communism, and also I think by Tony Judd called Postwar Europe, where he was saying that it is mistaken to think that the Soviet Union fell entirely due to external pressures or to economic pressures. One of the interesting things that happened, as these writers say, is that Gorbachev was trapped into his public image, into his extroverted public image on the one hand. He wanted to appear more democratic. And on the other hand, he underestimated the force of the nation state in people's minds. And that is why he allowed many satellite states of the former USSR to vote on whether they wanted to be independent or not. And I think all of them voted for national independence. Would you say that this is a kind of underestimation of the force of the love that people have for their nation that was completely, that people were blind to it during the Cold War? And you could say that this is interesting to note, but because it's one thing to say that people at large are blind to this. It's quite another to say that the leader of the Soviet Union was blind to this. What do you think
of it? Okay, it's a really interesting idea. I mean, I think, and having looked at it a fair bit over the years, the fall of the Soviet Union is fascinating to me. So I was a small child when the Berlin Wall fell. I remember seeing it on TV as a small child. What was I, like 7 or 8 years old, I think. It's a complicated thing. There's loads and loads of factors to it. Loads. And there's whole books written about completely different angles to it. Yeah. I would say one thing and I will mention about the national spirit of those satellite countries, places like Kazakhstan or Georgia or Belarus or something, is that the Soviet Union was held together by a force. Sooner or later, once you had a leader who wasn't sort of a Stalin, Khrushchev-style leader, prepared to send tanks into capital cities and shoot into crowds to put down national uprisings. Given enough leaders that weren't prepared to do that, then it was going to fall apart because it was only held together by a force, by physical violence. For example, East Germany, say, it was always going to be very, very, very difficult, maybe impossible, to force the people of East Germany to consider themselves Soviet.
Yeah.
That was going to be very, very difficult. And if you weren't forcing them to do it, if you didn't have a police state forcing them to be quiet and to do as they're told, then it was just going to be a matter of time. However, that's just one aspect, I think, a really important aspect of it. But it is interesting, isn't it, to see that as soon as Gorbachev said to countries like Kazakhstan or Belarus or wherever, you can have a plebiscite, you can have some sort of vote for your national self-determination. They were just overwhelmingly, yes.
Yeah.
I think that does speak volumes about the idea, the concept of a nation state, but I wouldn't put too much store into that. I think a lot of people like in Poland, they'd never ever really accepted rule from Moscow. Never.
Yeah.
So it was sort of a no-brainer. As soon as that release valve was given a millimeter, it was gonna go off. I think. Nonetheless, however, the point you're making, the wider point you're making, I think is completely valid. Speaking as an Englishman, and obviously you're from Greece, so I think this may even be even stronger in your heart. But I was raised from a child stories of sort of national greatness, stories of victories and defeats. You're raised with that narrative.
Yeah.
And it's somehow, I can't explain it really, but it's somehow just so deep down, so buried, so sort of at the center of me that it could never really be separated. I could never really, if I went and lived in another country and legally changed my nationality, had an Argentinian passport or a US passport or something, that would not change the things that are inside, the narratives that I hold dear.
Yes.
About England. And I'm sure you feel the same about Greece. The Greek flag means something to you, roundly.
Yes.
Right? And so where globalists or even communists or the idea of one world socialism, the idea of a global socialist society, they're fighting an uphill battle against everything I just described there. And it is a little bit difficult to define as well when people, enemies of the state, say things like, what is English? What does that mean? What is Englishness? You can't even define it. It's a thing that never existed anyway. Well, they're being very sneaky there because it is difficult to define in a quick, easy one sentence. It's not just a slogan. It is more than that. It's not that it doesn't exist though.
Yes.
So when someone says, "Oh, what is Englishness? What does it even mean to be English?" and people fumble around with an answer, and they say, "Oh, you haven't even got an answer."
Yeah.
It isn't a thing. That's one of the most disingenuous things ever. It's despicable to me, sickening to see it done. Whenever I'm asked a question or anything like that, I don't even engage with it. Realize I'm looking at a socialist or a leftist, and I'm not prepared to engage with their poison. So that's it.
One thing that I think we should raise is that the notion of a national identity and the desire for freedom of a nation is inextricably linked with a positive ideal of freedom. in the sense of a national self-governance or national autonomy. And this is part of what we did in symposium number two, where we discussed together about notions of freedom. So this notion of positive freedom does have its threats, as we mentioned, but it is a notion of freedom that wasn't particularly captured by Western countries during the Cold War. And I think that they viewed freedom in negative terms, in the sense of, in purely negative terms, in the sense of absence of interference with particular activities, particularly economical ones. Right. Now, I do think, as we said in Symposium 2, I think that both kinds of freedoms have something to give to us and have something precious. But it's important to bear in mind that we were somehow faced with a really simplistic dilemma during the Cold War, that, you know, we have freedom over here in the West without properly defining it, or at least in the entirety of the public imagination, and groups on the other hand. And I think, as you said, there is a kind of thirst for community and a kind of human need to belong to a community that contemporary liberals in a contemporary sense, that's what I mean, do not take properly into account. Now, I want to focus a bit on what patriotism is supposed to mean, and then we could discuss about how it became a bit more prominent in philosophical debate and now in political one. So patriotism is supposed to be love of one's country, and love here is a kind of sentiment, and its object is one's country and nation. Many people draw distinction between the two, and they see the country as more geographical, whereas they see the nation as transcending geographical borders. So they say that it's a very particular attitude that is really particular. It's really particular. It's particularistic.
Right.
Okay. And that it conflicts with the impartial view of morality. So in, let's say, in the 70s, the two most influential political philosophers in, let's say, the Anglosphere, I think, were John Rawls, we did about his view on justice in Symposium 3, and Robert Nozick's libertarianism. And there were people who think, who are communitarians, or go by the name communitarians, who think that both philosophies, despite their differences, do not adequately address the human need to belong. Mm. They treat human beings as abstract individuals, or as individuals that are somehow opposed to society and groups. And I think that this is interesting to understand this criticism, because the debate between communitarians and liberals is a really big debate. And it's really fascinating and sort of unpredictable. I haven't made my mind yet, but I do think both sides have something to offer. But communitarians raise a really interesting point, that liberals, contemporary liberals, are pointing forward an ideal of independence. Now, in a way, this makes sense. We do think that, you know, it's good to be independent, and it's good to think independently. But on the other hand, communitarians say, wait a minute, it is good in a way, but on the other hand, if we look at what makes life meaningful, we will see, or what constitutes living the good life, we will see that it is through and through filled with relations of dependence. So let me give some examples. We praise independence on the one hand and conceive of it as an ideal. But on the other hand, there's a question, how independent are we when we are, when we have a family? I think that in a family, we are dependent on each other in all sorts of ways. Psychologically, for instance. I am completely dependent on my wife, for instance, with respect to her influence on our kids. We don't have kids yet. I hope we will in the near future. So, but there is this idea that we are all dependent on each other, and we shouldn't, on the one hand, be afraid of being dependent on each other, because that is what being a human being implies. And that is what the human life requires, that we do enter into relations of dependence. And the same could apply for the family in general, a more extended kin. And you could say that it's also, dependence is also important, because we all talk about the freedoms we want to have, but these freedoms are, do not come unproblematically. We should not take them for granted. They're not a given. They're protected. And they are protected by people who are willing to fight for the their protection. So I think that in a way, the what communitarians are stressing, which is really important, is that, yeah, liberals are talking about freedom, but they are talking about freedom merely in the abstract. It's merely a potential, a power. And they say, they do not say much about what it is that we should do with our freedom. So what do you think about this?
Yeah, it's interesting. First of all, to say the idea that there's something deep down in, I think, the human condition, the human psyche, to want to belong.
Yes.
I just think that's completely undeniable. I won't even try and argue or anything. I just think that's just the case.
Yeah.
But then I think the question straight away is, at what scale is best then?
Yes.
Because on one end of the spectrum, you've got like extreme individualism, where everyone's their own unit walking around. Every person is their own little island that can support themselves economically and have no community, even a family unit. Interestingly, it's funny how communism, in the end, despises even a family unit. They want you to be collectivized into this grand collective, but smaller units they despise. Anyway, that's a side note. On one level, you've got individuals, and at the other level, you've got sort of a family unit, and then you've got sort of small hamlets, small villages, small communes even, of a few dozen people, something like that. And you've got small towns of 100, and up into mega cities, nations, nation blocks, or giant nations like China, Russia, America, or then just the entire global community. Which one's best? Well, that's a very, very difficult question, isn't it?
Yes.
And I don't think we have an answer. But one thing you talked about there, the thing that popped into my mind when you were talking about sort of the being dependent on at least your own family and things, or even your friends, closest friends. The thing that popped into my mind was the philosophy of Epicurus. He's the armchair understanding of Epicurus is usually fairly wrong. He was he's spoken of as a hedonist.
Yes.
That he encourages people to get drunk and have drugs and don't bother working. That's not what he said at all.
Yeah, I know you had this in mind. Yeah.
I know you know this. But what I had to do at undergrad, had to read a fair bit of Epicurus and write a few essays on him and things. He wasn't really saying that at all. He basically, to boil down some of the things he said, is that, because you said, what's best? The communitarians talk about what's best, what's living the good life, I think you said.
Yes.
And that's what Epicurus addresses. And he says, don't have to agree with this, of course, but to have a fairly decent home, not too over the top, not too extravagant, fairly decent home, a good relationship with your closest family, and a few very, very good friends that you can absolutely rely on, and a bit of nice food and a bit of nice drink, not to excess.
Yes.
He wasn't a hedonist. And that's it. That was obviously he's a man living in ancient Greece. So it's a very different world that he lived in.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.